Hi everyone, this is your host, Jenna Gibson. Korean Context is off this week for the Thanksgiving holiday, but we have a great rebroadcast episode for you here. This is an episode that we originally aired in 2016 about an ongoing issue in South Korea, which is how to integrate and deal with the issues that marriage migrants face and multicultural families face in South Korea. So I hope you enjoy, and we'll be back next week with another new episode. From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us on Korean Context. I'm your host, Jenna Gibson. For the last few weeks here on the show, we've been focusing on a lot of international and security-related issues. But this week, we're going to be diving into a domestic South Korean issue that has become very important over the last few years, and that is immigration and marriage migrants. Joining us on the podcast today is Daisy Kim, who did her PhD in political science at Johns Hopkins University, focusing on some of the problems that marriage migrants face in South Korea. Daisy is now a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Southern California, and she also completed a Fulbright research project on the issue of marriage migrants and multicultural families in South Korea. So we're very excited to hear what she has to say. Daisy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to speaking with you today.
So to get us started, can you give us a general idea of the scope of this issue? How many multicultural families are there in Korea, and how exactly is it defined?
Sure. I'll start with the second part of the question first. In terms of the definition, the official definition is quite simply that a multicultural family is a family composed of a Korean citizen and a foreign national. But in practice and colloquially, multicultural families have tended to refer to women, mostly from Southeast Asia or China, who are married to Korean men and their families. And that's because the majority of multicultural families tend to be composed of this sort of couple. I would say about 80% of international marriages between Korean citizens and foreign nationals have tended to be skewed in terms of gender, where it tends to be the woman who's foreign and then the men are Korean citizens. And so in terms of the scope of the issue, there are more than 800,000 multicultural families, and that number is projected to grow. And in terms of the marriage migrants themselves, there's more than 300,000 marriage migrants, and that includes men and women. And the majority of those 300,000 are female or women.
It seems from reading articles and things like that, that the number of multicultural families has skyrocketed in the last decade or so. And you mentioned that it's projected to grow even further. What factors have influenced this growth?
So this trend actually has been happening for a long time, and longer than the media has covered it. So initially in the late 1980s, there was this sort of rural depopulation and decline in the rural areas. And one of the ways in which this manifested was that there was a bride shortage, and that there was a shortage of sort of young marriageable women who are willing to marry the bachelors who had sort of been left behind in the rural areas. And so this sort of created a sort of social and economic crisis. And that kind of created an environment in which commercial brokers or matchmaking agents could get in and sort of arrange matchmaking tours for these men to meet women, initially from within Korea, but that wasn't very successful. And so they started offering these tours abroad so that Korean men could meet women abroad. And it was a very sort of profitable business. And this industry really grew and took off in the 2000s. And so you see a correlation in the rapid increase in the number of international marriages between Korean men and foreign women. And this sort of really peaked in 2005. But what hasn't really been paid attention to is the fact that since 2005, there's actually been a decrease. And so in the long term, we suspect that this trend will actually decrease and decline.
I'm curious, what is causing a decline then? Is it kind of, it's a trend that has peaked and then is going to naturally decline? Or are there some factors that might be influencing the lack of popularity from here on out?
Sure, that's a great question. I think it's a combination of both. I think it's a natural decline in the sense that that population that was sort of the client pool for the sort of commercial marriage brokers is limited, and that, you know, once they find brides, they're no longer on the market and looking for a bride. So there's that sort of natural decline that was inevitable, but there are also sort of other factors that are influencing this decline, in that there's been somewhat of a public backlash against international marriages, both in Korea and in the sending countries. Instances of, you know, domestic abuse and violence, divorces, sort of these very unhappy marriages, which have sort of discouraged the women from the sending countries to, you know, opt to marry with a Korean. And so there's been that external factor that's been influencing the decline in international marriages as well.
So that leads well into my next question, which is, how has the Korean population been responding, not just to marriage migrants, but to multicultural families in general? And I'm also particularly curious, as someone who taught in a middle school in Korea, how the children are being accepted or not accepted into the Korean population.
So generally, what has been kind of surprising and unexpected, I would say, is that the Koreans have tended to be favorable towards, especially towards marriage migrants. And that's largely because of a very targeted government campaign to portray marriage migrants in a very favorable light. Lots of TV documentaries and shows and dramas sort of telling the stories of these women and, you know, why they came, and especially sort of the sacrifices that they make for their families, and just really painting kind of a rosy picture that they're actually really contributing to Korean society. And so I think that has tended to prevent any sort of negative feelings from taking root. I mean, but that said, there's also the flip side of that, which is a sort of a growing resentment towards not just marriage migrants, but multicultural families in general, given the fact that over the past decade, it appears that the Korean government has spent a lot of money and resources into sort of educating and integrating multicultural families into Korea. And that's built resentment among some more, I would say, Koreans from lower socioeconomic backgrounds who feel that these resources are being taken away from them. So we do see kind of a growing backlash against multicultural families and multicultural family policies. And to address your last question about kind of attitudes toward multicultural children, that's something that the Korean government has been very sensitive about, in terms of how do we integrate multicultural children into Korean schools so that they're not marginalized in society. And that's largely because Korea also has a history of excluding biracial children from previous generations, mostly children who had, you know, Korean mothers and often American military fathers. And so they didn't really want to kind of repeat history of this sort of exclusion and discrimination against biracial and multiracial children. But I think because it's still something that Korea is grappling with, attitudes have tended to be kind of all across the board. I think there's a lot of well-intentioned actions and programs that have been instituted towards multicultural children. For instance, there have been sort of alternative schools that have been set up to educate multicultural children and to really foster, you know, diversity in schools. But at the same time, there are a lot of voices that say that, well, that sort of special targeting actually excludes the children further, and they actually feel more isolated. And so we're actually seeing a large number of multicultural children who are, you know, dropping out of schools and not doing well in schools. It's really a problem that I think will be with Korea for the long term, and it's something that, you know, policymakers are still grappling with.
Right. That actually leads really well into one of my questions that I had for you, which is, the Korean government has been making efforts. They have been instituting various policies to promote multiculturalism and tolerance and support these families. Through your research, what has been your assessment in general of these policies? Are they doing enough? Are there some places where they could get better? What have you found in terms of the government's response?
Yeah, so I would say that I do have to give the Korean government credit for achieving a lot in a short period of time. Given the fact that before 2006, there were virtually no programs for foreigners or migrants, maybe sort of at the local levels, but at least at the national level, there was really nothing for them. And so since 2006, the government has instituted a lot of support policies for multicultural families, and, you know, which led to this blossoming in the number of support centers. Often these support centers provide education, Korean language, cultural education, sort of auxiliary welfare supports. So they've really done a lot in that respect. And it's sort of amazing how much the support programs have grown. On the other hand, there's been a lot of criticism that these policies are sort of misconstrued and one-sided in the fact that a lot of them are really focused on assimilation, focusing on language acquisition, citizenship acquisition, and really kind of making migrants into proper Koreans. And in that sense, it's not so much about, you know, what do the migrants want, what do the multicultural families want, but more what the Korean government wants them to be like and how they should be, you know, integrated as members of Korean society. And the other criticism has been that there has actually been a lot of waste in terms of the resources, because once the Korean government instituted these policies, it sort of triggered a competition among, you know, local governments, civic organizations that really wanted to get a piece of the pie. And what actually happened was that they started offering very similar programs, you know, cultural fairs, street festivals, that was really just more about sort of showcasing the fact that, you know, diversity existed, and to show, like, sort of display different kinds of culture through food, or having, you know, Korean local residents experience different cultures. But at the end of the day, because there was sort of this duplication in terms of the services and programs that were provided, there's actually just been a lot of waste that hasn't really resulted in efficient and effective results. You know, these policies really intended for, you know, migrants to, you know, feel accepted and welcomed into society, but a lot of times they sort of ended up alienating them. And it's been kind of more about, you know, oh, what has Korea been really doing to show that it's multicultural without actually promoting, you know, tolerance and anti-discrimination, that sort of thing. So there's been a lot of criticism from sort of more progressive civic groups. So I think that in the long term, the government will have to reconsider and reevaluate where these policies are headed. But for now, yeah, the focus has been on cultural and linguistic assimilation.
So that's really interesting, because I want to ask you, as someone who has been studying this and really knows about this issue, where do you think it would be more efficient for them to spend the money? Where are some gaps that you think would be better for the government to focus on?
Sure, that's an excellent question. At least in the case of marriage migrants, studies have shown that they do experience higher rates of poverty. They tend to really desire employment, actually. And a lot of the women do come to Korea in order that, you know, they can make money and send that money back home to support their families. And so the Korean government has instituted sort of job training programs for the women, but it's tended to create this sort of niche industry where the women are sort of relegated to very limited things in the labor market. So things like being multicultural tutors, where they tutor other women and teach them, you know, Korean language, or they talk about their native cultures and their country to other children or other Koreans. Or, you know, they have been trained as hairstylists, for instance, or because a lot of them live in rural areas, it's been more about trying to sort of foster women to become, you know, local entrepreneurs or farmers. But these programs haven't really worked in the sense that there hasn't really been a good match between the skills and education that they have and the opportunities that are offered for them. So for instance, some of the marriage migrants do have, you know, higher levels of education. Many of them have attended colleges, but, you know, their degrees aren't really recognized in Korean. They don't really translate well. And so you have this kind of an excess of labor and skills that's not really being used and integrated into the Korean labor market. And I think that's a really key issue, that if you know, at least marriage migrants can become integrated into the Korean labor market and really kind of contribute in that sense, the issue of poverty wouldn't be such a big thing for the multicultural families, and they would actually be accepted more as equals rather than as, you know, a group that are basically considered welfare dependents.
I'm really interested to know what got you interested in this issue. What made you decide to start studying this and made you decide to focus on it for your PhD?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think it was just kind of opportune timing in the fact that I was beginning my graduate studies in 2006, and I also happened to do a summer internship with the American Embassy in Seoul at the time. And that was right when the government started its policies for multicultural families. And I started noticing, you know, all these media images and portrayals of migrant women. There was this very popular TV drama series where it was a bicultural, biracial Vietnamese Korean woman who was the main character. And I was just remember thinking, you know, like, why are they paying so much attention to these women? And sort of what was kind of problematic about the portrayals of these women, too. Because, you know, my understanding was that there weren't even that many marriage migrants at the time. And it seemed that there was just so much attention being paid to them. And so that sort of got me thinking and asking the questions. And I guess the rest is history.
Right. So your PhD dissertation was titled Bargaining Citizenship, Women's Organizations, the State, and Marriage Migrants in South Korea. So I'm curious, how did you choose to focus on these particular groups and what was the connection you found there?
So I decided to focus early on marriage migrants because at the time there was a lot of research on migrant workers in Korea, which has tended to be, it's a larger population of the migrant groups. And there's been a lot of research going on about the labor issues that they faced and how different social civic organizations were supporting the migrant workers and demanding their rights. But there wasn't as much focus on marriage migrants. And I really wanted to explore the sort of unique position that they faced in Korean society because they're the only group of migrants who have access to citizenship through their marriage to Korean citizens. Like migrant workers, for instance, they can't apply for citizenship unless, you know, they have some sort of family or, you know, marital tie to Korea. And so I found that it was very interesting in that in some sense, because they have access to citizenship and they can become Korean citizens, they're sort of a privileged group among migrants. But at the same time, they're also a very vulnerable group, too, because of, you know, high rates of domestic violence and, you know, sexual abuse that they experienced, things like trafficking, gross violations of human rights that I was reading about. So I was really kind of interested in this group in particular because of this duality that they faced. And then, you know, as I was doing my research, I became acquainted with a nonprofit organization that works to promote human rights for migrant women in particular. And through that organization, I found that, you know, women's organizations in particular were very, very active on this issue from the get-go. And they were kind of the early ones to, you know, raise the issue of gender in terms of the migrant problem and, you know, to really push for migrant women's rights when, you know, no one else was really paying any attention to them. And so that's what got me focused on women's movement organizations. And it actually made sense, you know, when I was doing my research, because the Korean women's movement has had a long history of promoting women's human rights and, you know, fighting for legislation that protects the victims of domestic violence and sexual violence, and also establishing, you know, hotlines and counseling centers and shelters for women. And so it was kind of, you know, in a sense, natural that these women's activists were hyper attuned to what was going on with migrant women. And so they were really quick to set up support services for migrant women, especially victims of domestic and sexual violence.
I want to pick up on something that you mentioned earlier. You were talking about some of the portrayals of multicultural families, marriage migrants. I know, for example, there was also a National Assembly woman who was Filipina. And so I'm wondering, from what you've seen, is that helpful having some of those either popular culture or real role models? Are they acting as role models? Are there some issues there? What is the role of having some more multicultural families in the spotlight in Korea?
Well, that's a great question. Again, it's kind of a two-sided thing. I think it's positive in that, at least with the election of Jasmine Lee, who's the Filipina that you mentioned, she actually inspired a lot of hope in a lot of migrant women and their children that, you know, they too could become politicians and, you know, speak up for the needs of other, you know, multicultural people. In that sense, it was actually a really positive thing. And, you know, it was also very progressive in that it's only been, you know, a few years since Korea started really accepting and opening up to immigrants, and the fact that, you know, this foreign-born person could become like a national legislator was quite a big accomplishment. On the other hand, Jasmine Lee experienced a lot of public backlash after election. There were all these kind of witch hunt campaigns, vicious, sort of malicious rumors that were spread around the internet about herself and also her children. And so there was a lot of ugliness that came out of her being elected to office, and resentment from certain groups of Koreans. And so I think in that sense, it was also kind of disheartening and kind of showed that there's a cost, right? When multicultural families and migrants are receiving the public spotlight in ways that sort of builds resentment among certain members of the public. So yeah, I think that overall though, that there needs to be more people like Jasmine Lee and people, you know, speaking up for what migrants and multicultural families need, because the reason why Korean government policies have been misdirected, I think, is because a lot of the voices of the migrants were not incorporated in the beginning, right? So it wasn't really kind of looking at what the migrants needed, but what Koreans thought the migrants needed. And so I think by migrant women joining more civic organizations and becoming more active in politics, eventually their voices will be heard. And so I think it's really critical that they do become, you know, active members who are very vocal and who do receive the public spotlight. And another good thing, I think, too, is that these kinds of portrayals serve as a counterpoint to the sort of more dominant media portrayals of marriage migrants as kind of these, you know, quote unquote, obedient and submissive wives and mothers. By showing them as, you know, politicians, I think it, you know, is a counter narrative to how migrants can become Koreans and be active in Korean society.
Okay, great. One last thing that you've mentioned a little bit, but I wanted to get a little bit more information here as well, that there are a lot of concerns, not just about acceptance and assimilation, things like that, but also how these women are often treated. I've seen some statistics that migrant women in Korea are particularly at risk for domestic violence, which you have mentioned as well. The rate of divorce is quite high. So what's being done to address those specific issues?
I think this is where the women's organizations have been very critical. They've been the ones to push for changes to legislation and policies in the case where migrant women have been victims of domestic violence. The reason why it's so tricky for migrant women to report cases of domestic violence and abuse is that they're afraid that their legal status will be revoked and that they would face or risk deportation, because oftentimes it's the spouse who's sponsoring the woman for their visa. And so if they divorce or if they leave the marriage, then, you know, they run the risk of not being able to renew their visas and then hence become illegal. And so a lot of women have been hesitant to come forward and say, okay, you know, I've been a victim of domestic violence. And so I think this is where women's groups have been really trying to push for measures that will protect the woman in cases of domestic abuse. And so, you know, they've provided shelters and, you know, anonymous hotlines, and really try to provide support services for the women. But at the end of the day, the system is still very disadvantageous for the migrant women, and especially if they're no longer married. Many immigration officials just basically say, well, you know, if they're no longer married, then, you know, they don't really deserve to be in Korea. So it's a very sort of challenging thing, an ongoing thing that migrant women face.
Okay, I do want to give you a chance at the end here, since we've talked about a lot of these different issues, but of course, you're the expert. Is there anything else that you think is important for our listeners to know about this issue?
I think that what's important is to sort of not take media portrayals for face value, because I think that a lot of them come with a particular agenda, especially a lot of the Korean media portrayals of multicultural families. There's tended to be a tendency to sort of portray things in a very rosy light. And I mean, I think that's good in a sense, but I think it also tends to gloss over some of the more problematic aspects of what is happening. So I think just kind of be wary of the sort of whitewashing that's going on. But I think that it's something that's really interesting for Korea's future and very critical to the ability to really welcome immigrants and multicultural families as Koreans will play a key role, I think, in Korea's future economic development, whether, you know, these people are integrated into the labor market as productive workers, but also really say a lot about, you know, what Korea is as a society and as a democracy. Is Korea able to include people from different racial and ethnic backgrounds? But I think what is really important to recognize is that, you know, for the first time, Korea is acknowledging that it's no longer an ethnically homogenous society, which for a long time, society really believed in strongly, and it still does. But I think that there's more of an awareness and a little bit more of an openness to accepting people from different racial and ethnic backgrounds. And I think that's something to be optimistic about.
Okay, great. It was a great discussion. Thanks so much for coming on the show and for sharing your expertise.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That's all for this week's episode of Korean Context. If you like this episode, please take a moment to rate our podcast on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts. And definitely tune in next week for another great episode.